Well, I guess we should say happy birthday, America. That's why I'm wearing my tie that is the closest to red, white, and blue that I could find. I bought this necktie when I flew Red Skelton up to Oklahoma City back in the 70s. We were having a huge, big salute to America with Anita Bryant and Red Skelton with the featured people there. We were backstage waiting for the program to begin, and Anita Bryant came up to Jim Thornhill and said, "Hi, I'm Anita Bryant." And it was really amazing because on the trip up there, when I was announcing that there was another jet airplane that was overhead, I said, "If you look up, you will see a 727 American Airlines jet." And Red Skelton is sitting in the passenger compartment, so he just went like this. And, of course, all he could see was the overhead over him. I was talking about looking out the window and then looking up, but Red Skelton was always clowning around no matter what he did. Have you ever really wondered why God started his work in the United States of America and not in England or France or Germany or in one of the other nations, the big powers of Europe? Have you ever wondered why God did not begin his work with a Spanish man, a Frenchman, a German, a Dutchman, maybe one of the black African men or tribe of Africa, of which there are many, many dozens, like an Igbo, a Hausa, a Hottentot, a Bushman, maybe one of the American Indians, like a Klickitat or a Kiowa or an Arapaho or an Apache? Why did God begin his work in the United States of America? How can you reconcile that or justify it or come to understand it? Well, by a little bit of a process of elimination, you can understand one major thing, and that is that we enjoy three basic freedoms, really four. Within those three, I did myself a little favor to look through the World Almanac and read a great deal of our history again this morning, including the lives of a lot of our presidents, and reading through the entirety of the Declaration of Independence, which is quite lengthy and lists all the abuses of King George. Read through much of the Constitution of the United States, read some of the history of the Great Seal and of our flag and of our national anthem to try to refresh my memory. The freedom of religion, the freedom of speech, and the freedom of assembly are the most precious freedoms you can even begin to imagine, and they do not exist in many nations in this world even today. I was reading a little bit of the Shanghai News this morning. I decided to interrogate the internet and read a little bit of the English language newspaper in China. So I simply got up the Shanghai English newspaper. There are two major newspapers in China. The Shanghai paper is one, but the People's Daily is the other. And of course, the People's Daily is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. Now, wherever you look around the world, and this includes the English-speaking world in Great Britain and elsewhere, you find government-controlled press. To a large extent, Canada and Australia enjoy the very same freedoms that we do, not in the same measure and not because of the same causes or purposes, but nevertheless, they're very, very free countries by comparison. You all know that President Clinton has been over there in China with about something like 2,400 other people that he took over there, a gigantic number of people going all over the country, and it's being hailed as a wonderful thing and so on. I could talk about that for the next couple of hours, and that's another subject. But the point is that freedom of religion is a very tenuous and barely legal thing in China today. There are a few Protestant organizations, but they cannot legally incorporate. They are tolerated by the many, many different Chinese religions and by the Communist Party, but just barely. And wherever you look around the world, the freedoms that we have are not enjoyed. Now, if you would look up General David Sarnoff, he became a general later, but he was a Russian emigre that came over here at age 9, and he began to work for Marconi and eventually rose to become the president of RCA. In World War I, in 1916, just as the war was getting started in Europe and we had not really gotten into it yet, David Sarnoff opined that as chairman of RCA, he looked forward to the day when every American home would possess a wireless set, a radio set. You know what you do when you buy a radio in the United States? You go down to Radio Shack, or you go to one of the stores that carry them, and you buy it. You know what you do if you buy one in Australia or some other country that is comparatively free? You go to the general post office, at least this was true when I established the office down there, and you get a license for your radio. And the radio has a little license that is attached to it. In those countries, Australia is a good example, they limit the size of their radio stations to 5,000 watts so that it only reaches a certain area and will not compete with other stations of 5,000 watts, which is why we eventually were on 33 radio stations in Australia, and they did not allow 50,000 watts clear channel, which could reach the entire nation with just one radio station. When you stop to think about any government that would allow mass media in the hands of the general population, you're dealing with a government which is not a despotic government, not an absolute monarchy, not a dictatorship, not a military junta, but a government that is of the people, for the people, and by the people, and a government that believes that mass communication media is and should be safe in the hands of the general public. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, freedom of the press. These are things that are virtually unique and that were fought for through many, many wars in the United States until finally we are able to do God's work without fear of persecution, at least during this time, without fear of being shut down by the federal or the state government, without fear of having jackbooted soldiers raiding the place and rousting us into prison because we are Sabbath keepers. But that can happen in other countries. I want you to understand a little bit about why our great seal in the United States has so many interesting replicas or replicates of 13. If you'll turn to the 48th chapter of the book of Genesis, I don't know how long it's been since you have read this, but when elderly Jacob, or Israel, his name was changed to Israel, was about to die, you know that Jacob's favorite son was Joseph. And you remember only a few weeks ago, and I was talking about Joseph's brothers and how Joseph was sold into Egypt, and that was actually allowed of God to provide a place for the nation of Israel to grow up to become a great nation, to be delivered under Moses out of slavery, and to inherit the promised land. And how gracious Joseph was when finally he made himself known to his brethren, and how they wept and so on. Then all of those years that they were down there in the land of Goshen and were becoming a great nation was because God allowed Joseph to be sold into slavery by his own brethren, Reuben, and then, of course, Judah, who said, "What profit is it if we slay him? Let's sell him to this camel caravan." Now Israel is very elderly. He's about to die. Verse 8 of chapter 48 of Genesis. "He beheld Joseph's sons and said, 'Who are these?' And Joseph said unto his father, 'These are my sons whom God has given me in this place.' And he said, 'Bring them, I pray thee, unto me, and I will bless them.'" Now the eyes of Israel, that's Jacob, changed to Israel, were dim for age so that he could not see. He was almost totally blind. He could see a form. When he said, "Whose are these?" he could see there were people there. There were children there, but he couldn't really see the features. "He brought them near unto him, and he kissed them and embraced them." They were his grandchildren, and he was very, very happy to see them. "And Israel said unto Joseph, 'I had not thought to see thy face.'" Remember how distraught he was when they brought the coat of many colors dipped in blood, and he thought that his favorite son had been killed. "And lo, God has shown me also thy seed." And Joseph brought them, the two young boys, out from between his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand, and Manasseh in his left hand, toward Israel's right hand, because he wanted his elderly, or his firstborn, Manasseh, in his left hand to be near his father's right hand to receive that right-handed blessing, which would pass on the blessings that he knew he had inherited from Jacob, and Jacob had inherited from Abraham. Remember that Abraham's original name was Abram, and his name was changed to Abraham, read chapter 12, 17, and 22 of the book of Genesis, because he was to be the father of many nations. "Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near unto him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger. and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom thy fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed me all my life long unto this day. The angel, the messenger, that comes from the Hebrew word messenger, which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and let my name be named on them. That it is a very, very important statement to understand the Bible, to understand all of 1 and 2 Kings and all of 1 and 2 Chronicles, that the name Israel and the house of Israel was to be put on Ephraim and Manasseh, not on Gad, Zebulun, Dan, Issachar, Benjamin, Naphtali, and Asher and the others, but on Ephraim and Manasseh. Let my name be named on them. They would be called Israel and the house of Israel. And they became the greatest people of all of the tribes of Israel. We'll see that prophecy right here. And the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Look at the phone book in a big city someday and see how many Abrams, Abraham, Abramson, and so on there are. Look and see how many Isaacs and Isaacsons there are. And if you look back through history, you know that Sack and Sithe and Saka and Saxons and so on comes from Yitzhak or Isaac, the Hebrew way of pronouncing that. And you will see that that is true in Britain as well. Those names are there. And when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head and Manasseh's head. And Joseph said unto his father, Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand upon his head. But his father refused and said, I know it, my son, I know it. And he also shall become a people, and he shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. Now, just in passing, I know all of you have read, perhaps quite a while ago, the book that I wrote entitled Europe and America in Prophecy. But where else would you look on the entire face of the earth for brother nations who look alike, who act alike, who obviously have the same genealogical background, where one of them would be a company, a collection, a unit or a group or a multitude of nations, many nations, all the same peoples, and another would be one great single nation? Do you know enough about geography and history and about the national histories of different peoples in this world and even a simple map of the world to try to find any groupings of nations anywhere that would fill that bill? It doesn't exist, except in the case of the United States of America and the British Commonwealth of Nations, of the great nations that came from England, and we are one of them, of course, as is Canada, New Zealand, and South Africa, and Australia, and so on, shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them that day, saying, In thee shall Israel bless, saying, God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And you know, if it had not been for Abraham, and if it had not been for his children, there would never have been a world that had progressed at a point that we have progressed today. If you look and you ask yourself, I'm reminded of the song, it's a very beautiful song, it's not quite true, of course, but in one sense, if you project it forward into the millennium, I guess it is, there will always be an England, and England shall be free, if England means as much to you as England means to me. And back during World War II, when those songs were sung by very patriotic and beleaguered Britons who were under siege by Hitler's Luftwaffe, they were very stirring indeed. Yes, there will always be an England. But when you stop to imagine, what would this world be like if there had never been a British Empire? Now, on the one hand, you have two very extreme methods of teaching history in our schools these days, and it began in the 1960s when they began, instead of really teaching the kind of history they should have taught, they began tearing down, attacking, and demeaning the United States, its founding fathers, its founding documents, so that children going through history class today learn that George Washington was a slave owner, Thomas Jefferson had a black mistress, they learn that perhaps some of the great heroes really weren't heroes at all, but cowards. And you will find that youngsters, the boomers as they call them now, the 60s that are now mature adults, learned the kind of history that made them actually reject, resent, and hate the United States of America. So the way a lot of people interpret British history is in the eyes of the Sepoy Rebellion in India, or they look at England exploiting through the British East India Company all of the various colonies of Britain, when in fact, if it had not been for the Magna Carta, if it had not been for King John signing that document and the very beginning of English law, then the very conceptual ideas of the founding fathers of the United States, like Adams, Jefferson, Washington, Franklin, when they drafted our Articles of Incorporation, as it were, called the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, they would not have had the concept that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. The pursuit of justice, liberty, and happiness, I don't have that exactly correctly, I'm reading it again this morning, but that all men are created equal. And that is not a concept in the minds of the leadership of hundreds of nations on this earth, and it isn't practiced in those nations either. You ask, what would India be like today if it hadn't been for England? Well, it wasn't until the late 1800s that the British passed a law that the wives of some of the Rajas did not have to actually cast themselves on the funeral pyre of their lord when he had died. It was not until then that they quit burning the ashes in the Ghats and actually throwing them in the Ganges River, and I think they still do that in secret. And then they bathe in the river. They cremate people over there in their idiotic Hindu society, their cow dung society, where they worship the Brahmin cattle. The word Brahma means holy, the holy cattle. If it had not been for British law, and by the same token, if it had not been, if you look at some of the other great colonizing nations of the world, for example, I could prove to you there are books that will do it, and certainly there are certain indications we can go through here in a moment, that Zebulon is actually Holland. And we know that the Dutch were great colonizers and great explorers. You know, you remember the Dutch East Indies. And the Dutch are known for what? Remember your high school teaching? For extreme cleanliness, aren't they? They just wash, wash, wash all the time. We learned that about the Dutch. It's true. They wash their streets. They brush out and wash down those cobblestones. They wash their houses. They are a very clean, industrious, hardworking people. And they colonized these areas that were inhabited by some of the Indian-type people of the Southeast Asian area, the Malay-type peoples, called the Dutch East Indies. And if it had not been for these great colonizing countries, these nations would not have ever arisen out of a virtual Stone Age society. Look at the 49th chapter for a moment, and by a little of a process of elimination, I won't be able to take as much time with this as I would like because I have some other things I want to get to, but this gives you a little bit of a clue of where these nations are today. Jacob called his sons and said, now this is Israel, remember, his name was changed to Israel from Jacob, and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you what will befall you in the last days. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. Unstable as water, you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed. You can read that, how that occurred. You defiled it. He went up to my couch, and that is all it is said about Reuben. It can be demonstrated that Reuben is France. And you look at how many governments there have been in France, you look at the incredible instability of that nation, and you look at their proclivity. I won't go into that except to say that way back in the puritanical days of the 1880s, the 1900s, 1910, 1920, when things were very, very different in the United States, the one nation that was renowned for pornography and prostitution and all of that was France. The French have actually exported that type of life to other nations all around the world, and they have been very, very unstable. Yet at the same time, excellency of dignity. The French kings and the French emperors, and later on, of course, Charles de Gaulle. And the excellency of power. France has been a very powerful nation, but at the time that Hitler attacked, Hitler had an army one-fourth the size of the French army and defeated it. because the French did not have the will. And if you read that period of history, and when Churchill was so irked with them because they were crouched behind their famous Maginot Line, and Germans simply went around the north, came through the Ardennes forest, through Little Luxembourg, and outflanked the Ardennes, and outflanked the Maginot Line, and took France. And when you defeat an army four times your size, it's mostly psychological, and that's exactly what it was, because of their instability in their government and their leadership. Simeon and Levi are brethren, and they were the house of Judah. They were from the same mother. And Simeon and Levi cannot be told apart today. We would mostly call them Jews. And it said, "Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. O my soul, come not into their secret, into their assembly. Mine honor, be not thou united. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they digged down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath." And that relates, you will see the little interlinear designation there in your margin. You can go back and read of how they did that, and how Jacob was so incensed that they did. "For it was cruel, and I will divide them in Jacob, and scatter them in Israel." And sure enough, they were. Simeon and Levi had no inheritance, as did Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh had two sections of land, just north of Benjamin and Judah. There was east and west. And later on, you will see, well, that's all in other books, but it would be very fascinating to go through it as to why we had Northumbria and Southumbria, and why we had the Civil War and the Mason-Dixon line, and the difference between Northerners and Southerners in the United States of America, which is Manasseh. And it's all very, very fascinating to look into it. But these two, Simeon and Levi, were not given an inheritance in that land. Judah, you are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is the lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down. He couched as a lion, as an old lion. Who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah. They are the Jews. Nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. And that is a reference for the first time in the Bible of an individual named Shiloh, who was to be the Savior of all of mankind. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Binding his foal under the vine, and his ass's colt under the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk. You can look at the commentaries, that's a little obscure. They talk about the tremendous vineyards and a tremendous amount of wine and winemaking in ancient Judah, and whether that is really implied here or not, I don't know. Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea. He shall be for an haven of ships. What are the two largest and the two busiest ports in the entirety of the world? Rotterdam and Amsterdam, believe it or not. About a third, close to a half of that nation has been actually taken from the sea, dredged out, and then put on the land, and then dikes built up, and about a third or a half of it, I forget how much, I've been there and driven all over that area up to Texel, the island there, and all through northern Holland when the tulips were in bloom. And it is and has been a great seafaring nation and some of the greatest ports of the world. And his border shall be unto Sidon. Issachar is a strong ass couching down between two burdens, and Issachar is Finland. And he saw that rest was good and the land that it was pleasant, and bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant and a tribute. And for all of its history, Finland has actually been overrun and has been like subject to other nations. Russia has always been a great enemy, and even though the Finnish withstood Russia in the early part of World War II, just before World War II got going in earnest, they did lose the concession of that major naval base in the Baltic, and the Finns have never gone anywhere or done very much. Have you ever bought a Finnish automobile? Now, they may be making them today, but through much of the world history, they have never been known for anything except their vast forests and their fisheries and things like rosin and lumber and forestry products. But they were never a major manufacturing or industrial country at all. It said that they saw the land, that it was good, that it was a rest, it was pleasant, and they bowed their shoulder to bear somebody else's burdens and became a servant unto tribute. Interesting, even in following the process of elimination of the ones that it cannot mean when you try to understand who these people are. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent, by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse's heel, so that his rider shall fall backward. Interesting, it says in verse 18 in parenthesis, I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord, and Dan is omitted from 144,000. There are 12 tribes mentioned in the 144,000. Joseph is mentioned. And there are 12,000 from each of those tribes, but Dan is omitted. How many tribes are there altogether? 13. There are the 12 tribes of Israel, but only when you use Joseph and you neglect Ephraim and Manasseh, that were the two sons of Joseph, and when you count them all together, there are 13. So remember that, because we're coming to something very interesting in a moment. It's interesting that when the potato famine hit Ireland and so many tens of thousands of Irish emigrated to the United States, that almost all of them wanted to get into law enforcement. There was nothing so indicative of New York and of the Bronx and of the New York area around Jamaica and Manhattan and so on than a big old Irish cop. They wanted to be judges and lawyers and policemen. And I think it's interesting because it means God will judge. And it says, Dan will judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. When it says, I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord, you wonder why. And then you look at the incredible bitterness between the Irish and the British, and they are related. And you look at the incredible bitterness over there right now, where just the other day, a whole bunch of Catholic churches were torched in one day after all these decades of trying to settle this thing down in Ulster or Northern Ireland after British Army occupation, trying finally to get Sinn Féin and some of these people together. They did sign a treaty. They were going to try to have a coalition government and these Protestants and Catholics settle down and get along. Ireland, Ayr, is of course 100% Catholic. Northern Ireland, or Ulster, is divided about half and half. Church of England, Protestants, other Protestants, and Catholics. And it is a seething hotbed of absolute hatred. I think you might find that Ireland might eventually be a part of the United States of Europe, and that England will not be. You knew, or did you, that Ireland was neutral during World War II and was a hotbed of Nazi spies, was a haven for Nazi submarines. The Irish hate the British. And it says here, and you look at that seventh chapter of the book of Revelation, of how they are left out of the great innumerable multitude, and, well, they may not be left out of that, but they're left out of 144,000, and that omission, I think, is explained by this little parenthetical statement, I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. Gad, a troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. That may mean, may not mean, Switzerland. Out of Asher, his bread shall be fat and shall yield royal dainties. That may mean, may not, Belgium. We always thought it did. Not only because of some of the most intricate things you can find that grace king's palaces, such as Belgian tapestry and lace and Belgian cut glass and the fineries that are very, very expensive and to be very desired by collectors of fine arts who can afford that kind of thing, but for other reasons as well. Interesting, too, that Belgium is the site of the headquarters of NATO and that Brussels is really a world capital. Naphtali is a hind let loose. He giveth goodly words. Naphtali is very likely Sweden. And I find it interesting that the one nation that produced a man named Nobel, who invented not only dynamite, but then tried desperately to realize what the world was going to do with it and try to stop war, and has given the Nobel Peace Prize. And if anybody giveth goodly words, Sweden does, in the form of the Nobel Peace Prize. Joseph is a fruitful bough. Now, Joseph is both Ephraim and Manasseh, but it's using just Joseph here. And read this almost poetic expression of the great bountiful blessings that God would heap upon Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall, just growing, growing, and nothing can contain it. The archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him, but his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty, God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Fascinating reference. Remember that a little later on. The stone of Israel. The capstone, the headstone, the chief cornerstone. What kind of a structure is it where the capstone, the headstone, and the chief cornerstone are all one stone? Most buildings, if they are rectangular or square, if the principal corner is a busy intersection like 5th and whatever in New York City, then that will be the corner where they lay the cornerstone. What structure is it where the cornerstone is also the capstone? Only the pyramid. And the capstone on the pyramid is missing. Some people think that that has symbolism and significance, and we might too in a few more minutes. Even by the God of thy Father who shall help thee, and by the Almighty who shall bless thee with blessings of heaven above. That has to do with weather. Blessings of the deep that lieth under, and that has to do with minerals, with natural resources, with oil, and with heavy metals and things that are useful to man. Blessings of the breasts and of the womb, and that has to do with life expectancy and with physical health. The blessings of your father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors under the utmost bound of the everlasting hills in every point of the compass in all directions. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that was chief among, not separate from, if you look at the original, I have a little note right here that says that, set apart, not separate from, but set apart, designated as, from among his brethren. And we just saw that designation in the blessing of aged Israel who was about to die when he blessed Ephraim and Manasseh. Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. It may have to do with Norway, and it may have to do with the Vikings, or the Vikingers, as they were called at that time. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. You see, Joseph is one of them, and you count them, and there are 12. But when you add Ephraim and Manasseh, there are 13. Isn't it interesting that the United States of America started with 13 colonies? I have here a dollar bill. I wish you would all, if you can find one, if you have $1 in your pocket, would you take out a dollar bill? I think you will find something here that will be very interesting to look at for a minute. On the back side of the dollar bill, the green side, if you will look at it very, very closely, you'll have to get your glasses to count. You might want to do that when you get home. You might have it a little difficult to do right now. You will see on the front part of the great seal of the United States, and by the way, if you look it up in an almanac, it's quite interesting about how that seal was designed and by whom and over how many years it took, and that it wasn't until about 8 or 9 years after it was proposed that a totally different group of people finally designed it, and it was then modified a little bit and then accepted. If you look at the eagle very closely, there is a cloud. Some people wonder whether that cloud is not reminiscent of the cloud that was over the tabernacle in the wilderness. Be that as it may, it is maybe a, quote, glory. Inside the glory, or the cloud, are 13 stars. And they, of course, represent the 13 original colonies. If you look at the little banner in the eagle's beak, it says, E pluribus unum. Out of many, one, or out of one, many. Count the numbers in E pluribus unum. If you want to write it out, they're exactly 13. There are exactly 13 bars on that shield in the front of the eagle. If you look at its right claw on your left and count the leaves in the olive branch, in time of peace, friends, in time of war, enemy, holding out either one, as the American eagle does, you will see there are 13 leaves on the olive branch. If you look at the arrows and count the arrowheads, there are exactly 13 arrowheads. Now, if you go over to the obverse and you look at the word Anuit Soeptus, or Coeptus, means he, God, has favored our beginning. He has favored our beginning. Count the number of letters. There are 13. If you look at the form of the pyramid and the missing capstone with an eye that symbolizes the eye of God and the Spirit of God that sees throughout all the world, and the missing capstone that is to come back, that he will bring forth the capstone or the headstone thereof, crying, grace, grace unto it, as the Bible says. Count the courses of stones, and you will find there are 13 courses of stones in that pyramid shape. I think every bit of that is fascinating information. I was looking it up again about the origin of the Great Seal of the United States just this morning, but there's a lot more. If you were to write out right now, July the 4th, July the 4th, then count it. I will count it for you. J-U-L-Y 4, T-H-E 3, F-O-U-R-T-H, 6, 4, 3, and 6, 13 letters, in July the 4th. Throughout American history, the number 13, far from being unlucky, has been a very, very important and significant number. The first U.S. Navy, at the time the United States Navy was designated as being a Navy and was made into a Navy, possessed exactly 13 ships. The Confederate flag, even though there were only 11 states that joined the Confederacy, decided to put 13 stars in their stars and bars. Fort Sumter was fired upon, which was the action that began the Civil War, on the 13th. Dewey took Manila and defeated the Spanish ships in the bay on the 13th. World War I began under Woodrow Wilson. If you count the numbers in his name, there are 13. And the first United States expedition, singing over there, that boarded ships in U.S. harbors, sailed in 13 ships and took exactly 13 days to cross and got there on June the 13th in 1917. In the Battle of Belleau Wood, the first major U.S. engagement, it took place on the 13th of June. It was under General Black Jack Pershing, but General Pershing's name is John J. Pershing, and if you count the letters in his name, there are 13. You know, when I wonder, why did God raise up an American, and why did God raise up not just an American, any American, but my father, Herbert W. Armstrong, and then me to come along afterward as his son, I have to wonder, what would you have thought if you had heard a radio program where a man was saying, "Well, howdy y'all, welcome here to Radio Land. This is Herbert W. Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Sure is good to have you folks out there in Radio Land listening at me today." Well, I don't know. You can't put down people that talk that way because there are a lot of them that are that way on radio and television that I guess have large audiences. But for some reason, God didn't choose a man with that accent. But he didn't choose a man with an accent. Now, accent doesn't mean you're ignorant, by the way. There are a lot of people with thick, heavy accents, Southern, New York, Bronx, West Texas, as distinct from East Texas, and you can tell the difference, by the way. And Deep South, Alabama, as opposed to East Texas, and you can tell the difference. If you go there, you listen to them. And there are subtle little inflections and accents in Minnesota, Minnesota. They talk a little differently. But it was very hard to place Herbert W. Armstrong. You couldn't tell where he came from. You couldn't say Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, New York, Oregon. It was just Middle America. It was no accent at all, so to speak. It was just common American speech. But if he'd come on and said, "This is Herbert W. Armstrong mit the good news of the Heinecheheit. Guten Morgen, mein Herren, and willkommen to the Welt von morgen, the Welt tomorrow." How long would you have listened? So he didn't send a German. A lot of people in America think that British sound effeminate. Don't ever tell them that, because they are very rough people indeed. If you look at World War I and World War II, and you look at the soccer matches and sometimes the soccer riots, you will find out that Britons who go to Paris and go to to Germany and to France and get involved in a big melee following a World Cup soccer match can be very tough gentlemen indeed. But a lot of Americans think that because British tend to speak like this, you know, and they do talk just a little bit differently than we do, and they say, "Really? Well, we had a smashing good time, and chip-chip, and lips tight-lipped, and chin-up, old boy, and all that sort of rot." And so people think that Britons are a little bit effeminate. Well, they're not really. They're very, very masculine people. But God did not raise up an Englishman to come on and to talk to us in a British accent. But he raised up a middle American who had been reared in Iowa and learned in the Iowa public school system and then came to Oregon. You know, there are a lot of things to think about in connection with the work of God and how it must be conducted today and how it has been conducted from the time my father began it in 1934. First of all, I mentioned David Sarnoff. One of the great freedoms we enjoy is freedom of the press, but that also has to do with freedom of the electronic media, freedom of radio, television, and now, of course, the Internet. the freedom for you to go down here, buy a computer, log on, and do like I did this morning, and read a newspaper from Shanghai, China, without having to get a license, the freedom to go back and forth across state lines, the freedom to do anything like I did, sit at a typewriter, in this case a word processor, drafted up a constitution and bylaws, went down to an attorney's office, had it sent off to the Secretary of State in Austin, Texas, and we incorporated the Intercontinental Church of God. Before that, we had incorporated the Garner Ted Armstrong Evangelistic Association. And we are protected by law, and we are allowed to do that. We are allowed to petition the Internal Revenue Service for tax-exempt status. And we need your prayers on that behalf, by the way. They sent us a very technically worded letter. The attorneys are working on that. It's nothing that can't be overcome. It's routine, really. They ask all kinds of questions. They want samples of our literature, and they want all kinds of little technical questions answered before they will grant us our permanent. In the meantime, it is retroactive, so don't worry about it, because everybody does have a tax benefit when they pay tithes and or offerings to God's work. But that is a separate agency of government that, through the law that has been passed by Congress, all of us have to obey in paying withholding tax and in paying our income tax every single year. There are a few infringements upon our liberties that we take issue with, but by and large, we are the most free people, the freest people of any nation on the face of the earth, when you think of the precious freedoms that we enjoy. Not only, then, did the government decide that mass media was safe in the hands of the general public, but they insisted that religion had to have access to that mass media, and they passed laws that even local churches and local religion should have time on local radio stations and set aside blocks of time for that very purpose by law, so that no private owner — you could buy a radio station if you had the money, couldn't you? But you can only own 7. There's a maximum. And if you own a major newspaper, and you own a whole bunch of radio stations, and some television stations, the government might come along, as they did to KRLD and the Dallas Daily News, and say you got to get rid of one of them. So KRLD got rid of the Dallas Daily News, or vice versa, and they had to divest themselves of one of those because they are formers and shapers of public opinion. And they had just too much of their ownership and their management forming and shaping public opinion in one major market. So the government even limits that, but it is in the hands of the general public. A little radio station, KORE, that only covered a part of Lane County that I think was something like 150 watts, I forget, my father wrote it up in his autobiography, a man named Frank Hill called Herbert W. Armstrong, a ragtag little minister in an unpainted clapboard church in an unincorporated part of Eugene out on South 6th Street. And all the other ministers had had their opportunity on that Sunday morning 15-minute time for a local representation, free time to represent local religion. And there, of course, they wanted to have a potpourri of all of them so as not to show favorites. They weren't going to let the Catholic priest be there every single Sunday, or the Methodist, or the Lutheran every single Sunday, but they passed it around among all the denominations, and finally they'd run out of invitations. People didn't want to get up that early. They had what's called mic fright. And back in that day, that was a lot more common than today. People have really come out of that a lot more today, and they're not as taken with, I guess, the Kaltenborns and the various great speakers of the time. You remember the affectations of the FDRs and Teddy Roosevelts and the way they spoke. My father grew up during that time, which is why he spoke the way he did on the radio and tended to really overly dramatize a lot of what he said. And greetings, friends! He didn't say hello there, you know. It was different. He came on that way because he'd heard those speakers emphasizing their speech techniques that way. Well, during that time, they had pretty much gone through all the ministers and the pastors there, so they called upon Herbert W. Armstrong, and you've read about it, how he went down there and in a 15-minute broadcast just preach some subject or another. I don't have any idea what he talked about. But the phones began ringing. So Frank Hill called him at his home and said, we'd never had that before. We'd never had people call on the telephone and say, who was that man? That was very interesting. And when do we get to hear him again? Mr. Armstrong, I found out you have a good radio voice. You have a good radio presentation. How would you like to buy some time on my station? How about that? Offering a minister time on a radio station and asking him if he's able to pay for it to reach the general public. Talk about freedom. Well, it was $3 for a half an hour. My dad didn't have any $3. He had already given up the salary that I think was about $3 a month or whatever it was that they were giving him from Stanbury or Salem, West Virginia, wherever he was affiliated with at that time. And he's written it up in the autobiography, and I've forgotten that part, frankly. But nevertheless, the local church, it consisted of about 30 or 40 people, I think, were mostly very, very dirt poor farmers. This was right in the very great depths of the Depression, 1934. And they decided that they could subscribe to $1.50, I think it was. And Dad just said, we'll depend on God for the other $1.50, because that was a week, you know, that was a lot of money in those days, $3 a week, when people were working for 5 cents an hour, and you could buy a hamburger, a slice of pie, and a cup of coffee for 15 cents at Quickie Snappy Service, it was called, in Eugene by the radio station. 15 cents got you a hamburger and a slice of apple pie and a cup of coffee. So no wonder people worked for a whole hour for only 5 cents. So that was a pretty frightening thing. But the money did come along, and the radio audience began to build. My father began to produce what is called The Plain Truth, and he just mimeographed it and sent it out. First, my mother would hand address the envelopes, and a little mailing list began, and that's the way the work of God began in this age. Really, in a very short period of time, as history goes, that was 1934, and I was 4 years of age. Well, by the time I was back out of the Navy, at age 22, Ambassador College had been going for several years, since 1947. It had been going for 5 years, because I actually attended a few of the classes before I went into the Navy to make up some lost credits that I didn't have when I got out of high school, and then came back and entered Ambassador College in the fall of 1952. There were 36 students then. I was in a graduating class of four. There were 100 brethren. Remember Eddie Eckert and his wife? And she played the piano. There were 100 brethren in the church that met in the library building on Ambassador College campus at that time, and there were no other churches anywhere in the entirety of the world. Yet from that date, in those days, in the mid-1950s until the late 1960s, there were three college campuses raised up, and a church that grew to over 150,000 people and began eventually to accumulate in gross terms of income over 135, I think it grew to 150 and more, million dollars per year, published The Plain Truth, The Good News, Tomorrow's World, published those magazines in Spanish, German, French, Dutch, in several other languages. The radio programs that I would do in ad lib were then typed and scripted and then translated into Russian. They were broadcast all over in German, in French, in Spanish, and in Italian, and they were even sent via shortwave and other longwave radio stations from Radio Lorenzo Marcus down in off of Africa into South Africa, as well as up into Russia from radio stations in Central Europe. So people even in the Russian language could hear the broadcast in their own language at that time. That work, when you really look at that short period of time, just boomed up in a tremendous spurt of growth at about 30% per year, the most rapid growth you've ever heard of in your life. I have stumbled across in past years some of the old documents about the number of new referrals, the number of new baptisms, the number of people attending the feast, and it was just phenomenal. When we built that Redwood building, it was open. I was still in the Navy on that first year, I think, in 1953 when they met up there. And they had only a very few people come, but the very first Feast of Tabernacles that we had after I got out of the Navy, I remember there were something like 200, maybe 220 up at Siegler Springs in California. The very next year, there was something like 1,200. And the year after that, there was something like 3,000. The year after that, there were like 8,000. And so it grew. And by that time, the young graduates of Ambassador College were going out on baptismal tours all over the country. And some of these younger men were pastors of 2 and 3 and 5 and 7 churches and were baptizing people in droves, and the church was just growing by leaps and bounds. And it could only have happened here. That could not have taken place in any of the third world nations. It could not have taken place in any of Central or South America or Mexico or maybe Portugal or Spain, because they are 100% Catholic. It couldn't have happened in Italy, same comment. Couldn't have happened in France, same comment. 98% Roman Catholic. Could not have happened in Germany. Certainly could not have thrived during the very heyday of radio in the 30s, when radio was in its infancy and was really beginning to boom up. And my father started in 1934. World War II was underway, and the United States was that one isolated nation separated by two vast oceans that the war practically didn't even touch. But you could not have had a work of God going like that in England, and you can't to this day. We tried when we had Ambassador College going for years and years to get on radio, but there's BBC Home and BBC Light. And the stations that were anchored in ships that were out in the English Channel were constantly being persecuted by the government. They would eventually even raid them with torpedo boats and go out there and put people aboard and arrest them and carry them away. Radio Caroline, Radio Swan, whatever some of them were. No, Swan was down in the Caribbean. But there were the ship radios, and they insisted on calling them the pirate radios back during that day. And we could never buy radio or television time in England, and we still can't even to this day. I wanted to mention something to you about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was the second president of the United States. There's a coincidence that we heard the other night in a biographical sketch of Thomas Jefferson's life. I don't know if any of you saw this, but I had forgotten it. It was absolutely fascinating. Jefferson was the person who basically wrote the Declaration of Independence. Other people had some input, but he basically crafted it and he wrote it. And the others then signed it, and among them, of course, we know that John Hancock is the one main signature, but all of the others signed it as well, including Benjamin Franklin and so on. And when you read some of that, I might be able to have a minute or two to read part of it to you. It is really fascinating because these men pledged their lives, and their lives were on the line, to bring to birth a great nation under the concept of these freedoms that we're talking about. John Adams was the second president. Thomas Jefferson was the third president, because John Adams passed that Alien and Sedition Act in 1789. It contributed directly to the election of Jefferson, who was totally against it. They became a little bit estranged. They were pretty much enemies politically, but as they got older, Jefferson decided, I'm going to write to John, and he did, and John answered, and they began corresponding back and forth. That continued for several years, and they had very warm, lengthy, and interesting correspondence. July 4th, 1826, in late June that year, Jefferson knew that he was dying, and he wanted to hang on. And his wife had died many years earlier, but he told his house servants that he wanted to hang on. In the wee hours on July 4th, on the 50th anniversary of the United States of America, John Adams died. Jefferson was still alive. And apparently his last words were sometime in the mid-morning of that day, is it the 4th? And they said, yes, it's July 4th. And Jefferson died. He and that man died on the same day, 50 years after the Declaration of Independence, on July 4th. And I find that that is absolutely, it's beautiful, it's inspiring, it makes me think that Almighty God had a hand in it. And I know that God had a hand in the inspiration that he gave those men to write the documents that they did that have given me and you and all of us, and certainly the people in Canada and South Africa and Australia and England, anywhere else, can thank God for the great blessings and the liberties they also have. But these men, I think, God's hand was upon them. Now, instead of me saying that Washington was a slave owner and Jefferson had a mistress, you look at the qualities of character of that man and what he accomplished, and you can say these were great men who also had great weaknesses. They were human beings with offsetting weaknesses, but they were towering giants of their day. And to them we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude, because they were the founders of our nation. The Declaration of Independence is almost never read in its entirety. This is very tiny print. I almost never need it to wear glasses except for that, but I will just momentarily. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for our people, for one people, to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. That language kind of is interesting to me, even with regard to founding of a church organization and to the reasons why sometimes that is necessary. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Now we come to the part that most people memorize. That all men are created equal. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. That among these are life. The right to life. Our government has passed a law that does not allow millions of little unborn children that right. And that is a rotten, heinous, wrong law. And it should be overturned. But never will we become activists or in any way applaud those who try to take the law into their own hands and assault people or burn down clinics. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. It's very lengthy. It then begins with all of the terrible things that King George had put upon them. He has refused for a long time to allow, or I don't want to read all this, let's see. He has dissolved representation repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions of the rights of the people. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriation of lands. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount of payment of their salaries, and on and on and on it goes of all the abuses of King George. And finally, we therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other things, acts and things, which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And they did pledge their lives, because if they lost, they were all dead. They didn't lose, and that's why we are here today. And I think that since it is the 4th of July, and this is the nation's birthday, and it coincides with God's holy Sabbath day, that it's good that we go back to our roots and remember some of the men and some of the framers of the Constitution and the lives that they led and the risks that they took, the kind of men that they were, and also see sometimes the unseen hand of God in establishing this country in the first place. And instead of imbuing the youngsters who come to our history classes with the idea that manifest destiny was a brutal, rotten thing and taking up the cause of the poor Indians and how they suffered and this and that and make us into all a bunch of criminals because God himself, under Jefferson's administration, by the way, sent the surveyors all the way out to the Oregon coastland. And, of course, that was the time of the Louisiana Purchase. He was the one, Jefferson, that bought all the way from Canada to Louisiana and more than doubled the territorial size of the United States during that time. I just think it is good to rehearse the great blessings that we have of living in this free United States of America.